Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Al Capone is America's quintessential gangster. Before The Godfather and The Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire, there he was, Al Capone, notorious public enemy number one. Deirdre Baer has written biographies of Samuel Beckett, Simone de Beauvoir, Carl Jung. Now she's turned to Capone and the deeper story. This hour On Point, the gangster and man, Al Capone. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you know the legend of Al Capone? What do you know of the facts? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. There's been so much over so many years about Al Capone. Deirdre Baer goes in through the perspective of his family, and we're going to hear that. But there's been a lot, and for a long time. Here's a clip from the trailer from the 1932 film Scarface, The Shame of the Nation. The story for this film is based on a novel by the same name, loosely based on the rise and fall of Al Capone.
In the 1920s, the United States was reeling under the impact of prohibition. The sale of whiskey, wine, and beer was prohibited by law, but there were many willing to break that law. Gangsters took over. Crime flourished. Mobs fought each other for prime territories.
The Capone legend. A lot of fact there, too, but legend as well. Go flash forward. 1959. Film called Al Capone. Rod Steiger starred as Al Capone.
This is the true shocking story of Scarface Al Capone, who stalked out of Chicago to take America by the throat.
Anybody gives you any trouble, anybody gives you a back door, you tell them come see Al. They got to see Al Capone.
Stalked out of Chicago to take America by the throat. And here, flash forward, 1987, Robert De Niro plays Al Capone in The Untouchables. Here's a scene where Capone's being interviewed by reporters. He's asked about his reputation for controlling his business through violence.
I grew up in a tough neighborhood. And we used to say you can get further with a kind word and a gun than you can with just a kind word. And in that neighborhood, it might have been true. And sometimes a reputation follows you. There is violence in Chicago, of course, but not by me and not by anybody I employ. And I'll tell you why, because it's not good business.
Al Capone via Robert De Niro, The Untouchables, 1987. Joining me now from New York is biographer Deirdre Baer. Her new book out this week is Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. She's also author of biographies on Samuel Beckett, Simone de Beauvoir, Anais Nin, Carl Jung, and more. You can read an excerpt of her latest biography, Al Capone, at our website, onpointradio.org. Deirdre Baer, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Thank you.
You got family access to the heirs of Al Capone in a way that very few have ever done. Did a different picture emerge to you because of coming in through family?
Yes, it did. We all know the public Al Capone, whether true or not, and you've just played so many different versions for our listeners. I found the man behind the myth, according to the family. He was an Italian-American, as you said, born in Brooklyn, proudly American. If anybody ever called him Italian, he'd say, I'm an American and I'm proud of it. And he was an absolutely devoted husband, father, and son to a widowed mother, took care of his family, adored his wife, even though he had many mistresses, loved his son profoundly, and the family passed that on to the four granddaughters, three of whom are living and who cooperated with me in the book.
I want to talk with you about how to square that image of the great family man with the sort of super gangster who, in fact, did run a very large criminal enterprise, who you yourself say was responsible for the deaths of probably hundreds. Some people put it at 700, if not himself at all necessarily, but ordering those, and who could be pretty ruthless. But describe how he came up. His father had been the immigrant when he was, I think, fifth of seven children.
Where does Dad come from? Where did he grow up in Brooklyn? How did he get into the crime side of the world?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. His parents, Gabrielli and Teresa Capone, came around 1895. Al was there was Vincenzo, Salvador, and Ralph, and then came Al. So he was the fourth son who survived. There had been five. You were right about that. Mm-hmm. And he was the fourth surviving son, and he grew up in a tenement on Navy Street, which was the street that led to the main gate of the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And by the time he was 8 years old, he was a big kid. And he was the mascot of a gang that called themselves the Boys of Navy Street. And their main sport was hassling the sailors as the sailors exited from the Navy Yard. And by the time he was 12, he was a member of the gang. Rolling drunken sailors if they fell on the streets outside of the Navy Yard.
Rolling robbing them.
Rolling as in robbing, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it was an extremely tough neighborhood, gangs all over the place. The tenements were these sprawling slums. Jacob Riis, the great sociologist, said, "The Italians want to be clean, but their living conditions make that impossible." And so that was the background. He went as far as the sixth grade. Mm-hmm. He was a really good student, but he was never in the classroom. He played hooky so much that he had to repeat the sixth grade. And at some point during the year he repeated, he got into a brawl with the teacher, and he either knocked the teacher down or knocked the teacher out, and he simply walked out of the classroom and never went back. So his father, who was a tailor and who wanted the American dream for his children, the father wanted the children to be educated, and every one of those boys dropped out of school at the earliest opportunity and turned to petty crime. And so the father set Al up as a shoeshine boy on Columbia Street in Brooklyn, and Al became an entrepreneur. He didn't get his hands dirty, and that's mm-hmm. typical of Al in all of the crime. He didn't actually do the crime. He delegated. And in this instance, as the shoeshine boy, he sold his box to another boy, and then because other young fellows saw it was a good business, they set up shoeshine boxes, and Al extorted them. Paid Al Capone protection money, right, or you didn't work.
You suggest that in another age with different opportunities, he might have been a big CEO, that he had that kind of character. And, I mean, others look at how he ultimately organized his sprawling crime operations out of Chicago. Harvard Business Review did a case study on Al Capone just in 2009.
That was amazing.
It is amazing to consider. We'll look at that. But how did he then learn the ropes of big-time crime management, if that's what you want to call it?
He just seemed to have that innate ability. He's often compared to other Italian-Americans who succeeded legitimately. People said had he been born 20, 30 years later, he could have been Lee Iacocca.
Running Chrysler. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I do believe that because he had such skills at picking out the perfect people to do his work for him. And granted, it was dirty work. It was criminal work. But to have Harvard case study have their students read how he managed a criminal outfit, I think is just amazing.
He came into the realm of a guy named Joe Torrio, who ultimately was instrumental in him getting from Brooklyn to Chicago. Describe that relationship and how he got to Chicago.
Well, Johnny Torrio was a Brooklyn gang leader, and he was also either a relative of or very close to Big Jim Colosimo and his wife Victoria, they ran all the brothels and the gambling in Chicago in the early years of this century. And by 1920, Johnny Torrio had moved from Brooklyn to Chicago. Now, this guy deserves a biography on his own, but believe me, I'm not going to write it. Okay. Somebody else can do it.
Okay.
So anyway, Johnny Torrio, Al worked for him, and Al was a bouncer, the busker who persuaded the Johns to go into the brothels, a low-level bartender, absolutely nothing.
When he first got started, in his teens.
Yeah, when he got started, he was in his teens. Mm-hmm. By the time Al was 19,
and that's back in Brooklyn when he's doing that.
But, okay. In Brooklyn, yeah. So Al in Brooklyn, by the time he's 19, he's a father first, and then after the child is born, he marries his wife. And then Johnny Torrio calls for him, takes him to Chicago. This was around 1922. Mm-hmm. By 1925, Johnny Torrio had retired, and Al was the head of the outfit. He's 25 years old. By the time he was 30, 31, he was on his way to prison. So that, to me, was one of the most surprising things I found in the book. Here we are, 70-plus years later, after Al Capone died, and his legend just increases exponentially, and he was only on top of the world for 5 years. That's how brief his reign was.
But it was quite an operation he was running. The outfit was a huge, sprawling, illegal booze and brothels and gambling. It was enormous.
Oh, it absolutely was enormous. He had 400 or 500 people directly on his payroll. Those were the thugs and killers and whoever else. But he'd say, he said, if you put me out of business, there are going to be 2,300 Chicago policemen and politicians who are going to be desperate for the money that they now get because they're on my payroll.
His payroll, more than just the killers. I mean, he moved a lot of product. But he also, I mean, do you buy the number 700 for the number of murders that he may have been responsible for?
You know, it depends on who's counting. I call the scholars, I pick up an expression that a previous biographer used. He called the people who study crime gangsterologists. And for me, that's sort of a basket term. Covers the historians, the political scientists, the economists and sociologists. And the figure varies from anywhere from 350 to approximately 700 killings.
That's a lot of death. That's a lot of death.
That's a lot of killing.
No matter how you look at the great family man, as you describe him behind that. George DeBerry, we want to come back and learn more about that. The new biography is Al Capone, His Life, His Legacy, and Legend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Al Capone, the gangster who ruled the Chicago mob empire, and Al Capone, the man, with Deirdre Baer, his biographer. Her new book is Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. She's done biographies of Simone de Beauvoir, of Anais Nin, Carl Jung, Saul Steinberg, the New Yorker cartoonist, Samuel Beckett. But this time, it is Al Capone with that kind of incredible story that we all think we know. A lot of truth in it, but there's a lot of fable there as well. You can join us this hour. What do you know of the Brooklyn immigrant family kid who became the big Chicago mob boss? What do you know of Capone's booze running, his brothels, his gambling, his brutality? What about the other side of Al Capone? Have you felt a sneaking admiration for Al Capone or just revulsion at his murderous ways? Not everybody talked Al Capone down. Of course, there's plenty that did. But here are two dancers from Colosimo's Saloon in Chicago. This is Rudy Horn and Kate Krakow. They did an interview together for the biography documentary of Al Capone's life. A great guy, they said.
He used to come in with four or five guys. And they'd all sit at the table, and then the girls would come over, the hostesses in the club. They'd all come around, make a big fuss over him, and he'd give them money. You know, he was very liberal.
He was a very nice person, as to know him, you know. And what they said so many, he never did anything. It was his people that did it.
Yeah, very, very nice person. He died in 1947. We'll look at the whole span of that life. I mean, here's another bit. This is after his car was shot at by a rival Chicago gang in 1928. He ordered a $20,000. And bear in mind, at the end of his life, he was worth the equivalent today of something like $500 million, it is said. But he ordered this very fancy Cadillac with steel armored body, police radio receiver. After his arrest, news media were fascinated by the 7-ton car. Here's newsreel footage from that time, excerpted from a documentary called The St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Another feature about this car is that it is equipped with bulletproof glass throughout. These doors weigh 10 stone, each and every one of them. The windshield, the glass on the windshield is 1.25 inches thick. On the doors, it is 1 inch thick. It is all encased with steel packing.
Deirdre Bear, did you follow the story of this car? Was he that loaded and that worried that he could have an armored car? It sounds like on the presidential level there.
Well, yes, he was that worried, and he did have such a car. He had several such cars, and today, every time one of them comes up for auction, it's considered to be the one and only, and it really isn't. There was a rumor that when World War II was about to break out, Franklin Roosevelt, our president, used Al Capone's bulletproof car. Well, Franklin Roosevelt may have used a bulletproof car, and at one point it may have been Al Capone's, but we've never pinned that rumor down, so that's just another one to throw into the mix.
You describe him taking over when Johnny Torrio retired was the word you used, but I mean, getting from Big Jim Colosimo in Chicago to Johnny Torrio to Al Capone, there was plenty of violence just in that succession.
Oh, in those few years, in the early years of the 1920s, the streets of Chicago literally rolled in blood. There were one killing after another as the gang wars fought. And the thing about Johnny Torrio
was
that
he always...
Big Jim
was killed. Johnny was beaten within an inch of his life.
He was... Johnny Torrio and his wife had gone shopping, and they were coming home, getting out of the car, loaded down with packages. And a rival gang member drove by, two or three members, mm-hmm. and they wounded Johnny mm-hmm. Torrio so that he was in the hospital for a month, and Al Capone slept every night in Johnny Torrio's room, I guess shotgun, big guns beside mm-hmm. him, mm-hmm. To protect Johnny.
In the hospital.
In the hospital, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's where he stayed. And Johnny wisely decided to quote unquote retire, but he didn't really retire. He moved back to the New York area. I think he lived in White Plains or Yonkers somewhere mm-hmm. up there. And he had a lot of influence. He dictated a lot of what the gang should do when Al took over. Johnny Torrio walked away. Al was 25 at the time and said to Al, "You run things." And Al did from then on he went to jail.
Yeah, describe the scale and reach of the criminal enterprises of the outfit in Chicago, as it was known, that Al Capone ran.
Well, they moved into every possible kind of union. They took over. They took over everything from the dry cleaners to the movie theaters. Everybody had to pay protection money to Al Capone if they wanted to stay in business. And entertainers, Joey Brown, prominent among them, decided that he was going to go and sing in another nightclub or perform his comic act in another nightclub, and he got beat up within an inch of his life. And Al paid the hospital bills and said, "From now on, you need to work for me." And Joey Brown did. That's the kind of thing. The reach was enormous. All these unions, they were even in 1927 going to the West Coast, trying to take over the movie, the actual movie production, movie studios. Just can't begin to describe them all, but tentacles were so deep.
They knew how to put the squeeze on to extort. How did that side of their revenue, and they were making, I'm reading here, $100 million a year at one point. How did that compare with the booze and the brothel and the gambling, the sort of direct operations of their own?
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, I think those figures are the 1920s figures, so you can imagine what they'd be today.
Yeah.
Some people estimate that by the time he went to prison and lost everything, that he was worth $500 million. personally. That was his personal fortune. So you can imagine he had, as I said, at least 400 people on his direct payroll, and then all the other protection money that he had to pay. They found some of his books when the tax evasion trial started, and in the books, he had various names, his name, his brother, the various other people in the mob who got the larger proportion of the earnings. And then they had Citi, and Citi referred to all the politicians they had to pay off.
A politician or otherwise, if you got on the wrong side of him, you were in trouble. Here's an amazing bit of tape. This is from Robert St. John. He was a newspaper editor and founder of the Cicero Tribune in suburban Chicago. In 1925, he exposed town leaders on Capone's payroll, and the paper detailed a brothel and what was described as a secret torture chamber there run by Al Capone's brother Ralph. Capone's goons found him, St. John, on his way to work, beat him severely. Here he is in that biography documentary on Al Capone.
This car screeched to a halt and four men jumped out. I recognized Ralph Capone immediately. And they headed for me, and I was halfway across the intersection. I dropped to the ground, curled up, and put my head between my legs, and they gave me a real working over.
On the other side of that, Deirdre, you say Al Capone paid his hospital bills and, I think, bought his newspaper?
Yes. The thing about Al Capone, I seriously consider him the inventor of spin. He used the media. I won't make any present comparisons, okay, but I'm thinking about them. Mm-hmm. And, he bought the Cicero Tribune. It became his mouthpiece because he couldn't get the Chicago Tribune. He moved to Cicero. He moved his operation out of the city of Chicago because he was running into too much do-good enthusiasm to clean up the city. Mm. And he thought he could take over Cicero, and indeed he did. Cicero, the population was mainly Bohemian immigrants from the Bohemia part of what I suppose is now Czechoslovakia, and they liked their beer. There were no brothels and no gambling dens in Cicero when Al went in, and within a year after he was there, the town was filled with them. So he owned Cicero. That became his headquarters. But with Robert St. John, he was impeccably honest. He could not be bought. So he had to
be
the
journalist was impeccably honest.
The
journalist. Went on to a great career in journalism, yes.
Exactly. But so many others, I think it was the Chicago Herald Examiner, mm-hmm, one of the editors was on Al's payroll. It worked like this. Al gave him so-called scoops while he told Al how to behave, how to comport himself so that good stories could be written about him. He said to Al, you know, you're behaving like a buffoon and a hooligan. You got to clean up your act. You got to tone down these bilious yellow, banana yellow suits and pea green suits that you wear. And, you know, you can't sport an 11 carat pinky ring with a big diamond in it. You got to tone things down so that we can write positively about all the good things you do. So Al was a great manipulator of the media.
So when you say spin, it wasn't just buying a newspaper. He would work with reporters. They would work with him. He would pay them for coverage or just give them good stories or a combination?
Both, all of the above. And one reporter in particular, a man named Jake Lingle, was murdered, gunned down. Jake Lingle, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, was on his way to the races, and somebody followed him into the subway station and shot him in the back of the head, got away with it. Of course, nobody saw anything because it didn't pay you to see anything. They never found the murderer.
What was the image that he wanted portrayed or that they gave him that was more positive? Was he described as, I mean, he was public enemy number one in Chicago. How positive could that be?
Well, he wanted to be known as a benefactor. He wanted it known that if a newsboy on a cold and rainy night had a pile of unsold papers, Al Capone would buy them and give him enough money for him and his widowed mother to live comfortably for a while. Or Al Capone set up a soup kitchen when the Depression started. Well, sure, he set up a soup kitchen, but the real truth was that he probably extorted small businesses into providing the food for it. He didn't have to pay for it. So these were the kinds of stories, you know. Al Capone, he invited reporters into his house one time. In his mother's kitchen, he was wearing a pink apron and stirring a pot of spaghetti sauce. He never cooked. Never cooked anything in his life. And so there he is, you know, stirring this pot of spaghetti and inviting reporters. Yeah. So the reporter sat down and ate all his mother's wonderful Italian food, drank all of Al's illegal booze, but that never got into the story. Mm-hmm. They just went out and reported what a wonderful family man Al Capone was.
Let's go to our callers. Oklahoma. David is calling from Oklahoma City. David, you're on the air.
Tom, good to be with you.
You too.
I grew up in Chicago. I was a little kid when Capone went to prison. I can still see his picture on the front page of the Herald American. Capone in prison, and the big bug-eyed thing as he, you know, flashed on. And I remember the thing from the movie when Al Capone said, "You can get more with a kind word and a gun than you can with a kind word." And I think that kind of tells a lot about him.
What did you think of him as a kid growing up in Chicago, of the reputation?
Oh, well, I didn't know, you know, I knew right from wrong, but I knew he was wrong. He was a folk figure. He wasn't a folk hero. People despised him, but they had to like him, perhaps at the point of a gun. But he was bigger than life. He was bigger than Chicago, and Chicago was big then as it is now.
Yeah, it was pretty big. David, I love that memory of growing up with Al Capone looming. One more right here. Lane in Tennessee, Montague, Tennessee. Lane, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
So there is an old house in Montague that is now a restaurant, and the legend is that it belonged to Al Capone. It is the highest point on altitude-wise between Chicago and Miami, and it was his vacation home when he used to travel between the two cities. Now it's a restaurant called High Point, and I recommend going there for a steak if you're ever passing through Montego. But it's a really neat old house. It has old tunnels underneath that used to run to the train station. The train station is no longer there. But has a lot of neat escape routes and just kind of a neat piece of mafia history for this small Tennessee town.
I love it. There are many, many places that claim an Al Capone connection. What about this one, Deirdre Bear? Does it make sense to you? Would he have driven back and forth? He had a big Florida life that he was part of. Might this have been a stop-off place? Can you confirm?
I'll just give you a quote that somebody who studied Al Capone's whereabouts wrote. This gentleman said, if Al Capone had eaten in every restaurant, slept in every hotel, built every tunnel, he would hardly have had time to run the Chicago outfit. So I did end up debunking a lot of myths, a particular one that I'll just mention, sort of a correspondence to your callers. He was said to have gone to Baja California, just over the line in Mexico, where he had tunnels built to smuggle booze in, and he built a hotel and he built a casino. Well, the thing is, the hotel had been built, let's say, a good 10 years before Al Capone, who never set foot in Baja California, by the way, before Al Capone went to Los Angeles for a very brief visit. There were no tunnels because it was a sandy beach, and Mexico never had prohibition, so there was no need to smuggle booze into Mexico.
Leave that one aside, but he did have a big Florida life. He must have driven back and forth. I presume he wasn't flying that much in those days. I mean, could it not be that that was his place on the way down? Or I hate to...
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know. Mm. There are so many places between Chicago and Florida.
Of course.
And so many. There are so many of them who do claim that he stopped there.
Yeah.
He probably did. You know, we just don't know.
Eric in Madison, Wisconsin. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi. Nice to speak with you. I was a boy in history class with... a teacher by the name of Mr. Mitchell, he told us stories about when Capone would come through the little border town in Illinois and Wisconsin and have his bootlegging convoy coming up through, and the gunners would be in the front, and the the cars would be loaded up with booze and all squatted down, and Capone would mosey through our town on his way up north with the alcohol for the lumberjacks, I guess.
Wow, a convoy moving through town, cars loaded down with booze, and the gunners up front. Again, Deirdre, I mean, the legend is large, but he moved a lot of booze in those years.
And you know, your caller is probably correct in this one, because both Al and his brother Ralph, who was his right-hand man in the Chicago outfit, they each had a house in northern Wisconsin up around Hayward. Al's hideaway, before he went to prison, he liked to go up there as much as he could. And I've had, I have quite a few stories in the book from people in the little towns, which correspond to your caller's memory. So that part of the legend is true.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Al Capone, the gangster, the man, with Deirdre Baer, writer, biographer, author of the new biography, Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. She joins us today from New York. Of course, Al Capone, Brooklyn kid who ended up in Chicago with a very sprawling criminal enterprise, huge legend built around him, bought part of it, intimidated his way to another part of it. Hundreds of deaths attributed to him, not directly most of them. Clean hands was one of the philosophies he picked up from Johnny Torrio. But sometimes, well, we'll ask Deirdre Baer. The famous scene from the 1987 film The Untouchables, Al Capone, played by Robert De Niro, is at the dinner party with his associates. And he's learned of a plot hatched for two of his hitmen to kill him and take over the gang. He frames the betrayal using a baseball metaphor as he walks around the big round table over fancy dinner. Right after the line you hear at the end, he beats an associate to death with a baseball bat. Here's that clip.
A man stands alone at a plate. This is the time for what? For individual achievement. There he stands alone. But in the field, what? Part of a team.
Teamwork.
Looks, throws, catches, hustles, part of one big team. Bats himself to live long day, Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, and so on. This team don't field, what is he? You follow me? No one.
Boom. And down comes the baseball bat. Now you've got Deirdre Baer, a motivational speech and almost public murder all at once. Famous scene from The Untouchables, 1987. Is there a basis in the history, in the fact, for that scene, Deirdre?
Yes, there is. What we do know is that those two men, Scalise and Anselmi, were murdered. They were placed in their car, which a lot of people think is the beginning of the expression, I'm going to take him for a ride, because they were taken for a ride across the border into Indiana, where their car with their corpses in it was burned to a crisp. So that part of the legend is true. The other part of the legend, was there a baseball bat? How did the baseball bat get into the restaurant? Was it a restaurant? Was it a speakeasy? Where did this murder actually happen? Nobody can authoritatively pin down where the murder took place. But the murder did take place, and the two men and their burned-up bodies were found across the border in Indiana. So over the years, this is another one of the legends that just grows and grows. Everybody adds a detail, and everybody has something creative to say. And the next thing you know, you've got this really smashing, in every sense of the word, smashing scene in a movie.
Yeah. We've got so many callers for you with stories of Al Capone. You can be our fact checker here if you
sure.
can. Carl in Miami. Thank you for calling, Carl. You're on the air with Deirdre Baer in New York.
Thanks for taking my call. This is a little bit of a sidebar. I was driving up
for an appointment today, and I turned on the show. I grew up on Miami Beach and attended a parochial school there. And Al Capone's son, nicknamed Sonny, went to school there. We used to see pictures of him, you know, in the yearbook along with Desi Arnaz and some other people. But as a youngster in the early 60s, we used to go and walk into the Capone home on, I think it was either Hibiscus Island or Palm Island, one of the man-made islands opposite the MacArthur Causeway. Of course, the house was empty, and we kids, you know, it was vagrancy, of course, but we would go in and traipse around the house and go into the pool. There was no water in the pool, but we would just play ball and just hang around there and do different things like that. And after, I remember there was a restaurant also on Miami Beach called Sonny's, and that was his son's restaurant. We used to go there a lot as a family or whatnot, and then he, at some point, he sold it. I'm not sure what year that was, but I just thought I'd bring that to your attention. And it was one of those things where you're a kid, you're watching The Untouchables on television, and all of a sudden you're in, you know, this bigger-than-life man's home.
Was it abandoned at the time, Carl? Is that the deal or what?
Yeah, it was abandoned. Actually, I know it was, I believe it was recently torn down, and a McMansion was built on that site, but had been abandoned for many, many years. It was a very big, you know, a home for Miami Beach style. You call it estate, but yeah. It was probably maybe two or three lots. And it was, you know, we'd go in and, I guess, again, you know, not doing anything malicious, but yeah, we would just traipse around.
Just
and
being kids.
And just, yeah, we were kids, and we would just, you know, walk wild around. And too bad nobody had a camera to take pictures and whatnot. But it was one of those things that that we did as a kid. And as I said, the school that I went to, I believe he was a big benefactor to having it built way back when he was, I guess it was in the late 20s.
Hey, Carl, I appreciate your call. I'm looking at a photograph of Al Capone right here. He's standing in a bathing suit, which at that time, for him anyway, meant kind of a sleeveless T-shirt and dark shorts. And he's in Florida, old car parked behind him. This is sometime in the late 20s or early 30s. Could be Miami, this photograph. This is from the Smithsonian. Deirdre, what about his place in Miami?
Yeah, it was on Palm Island, and it wasn't torn down. It just fell into terrible disrepair, and it was restored several years ago. A consortium bought it and decided to make it a place for weddings or parties or whatever one wanted to do with it. And now I understand that it's up for sale again. Allegedly, one of the European soccer kingpins was supposed to be buying it for his own residence, but That was a rumor that was never confirmed. But the thing about the house, Al bought the house, I think, around 1927. His wife, May, absolutely adored this house. And she decorated it in good taste, slightly over the top, but in relatively good taste. Al had a swimming pool built. At the time, it was the largest swimming pool in Florida.
Wow.
And he loved swimming, and he loved boating. He had a dock, a deep water dock, so that he was able to have a large a yacht, I suppose I'll call it a small yacht, there. All his family gathered. He had the walls reinforced, and he had a gatehouse built where his guardians could be. Sonny went to St. Patrick's School in Florida. That's the school your caller is mentioning.
He had only one
and
child.
The only child. Mm-hmm. And his classmate was Desi Arnaz Sr., not Lucy's husband.
Okay.
Sr.
Okay.
And he did own a restaurant. He bought a restaurant with a man named Ted Traina, and eventually, he bought Traina out, and so it was Sonny's restaurant. And unfortunately, he was not a good business manager. He wasn't able to make a success of it, so he gave up the restaurant business. At St. Pat's, Al didn't have the school built. He may have been a benefactor. He probably was, because he was so generous in anything connected with his beloved son. Mm. And the one story that really struck me was Sonny wanted to have a birthday party and invite all his classmates. And May said, sent out the invitations, and she put a form with the invitation that the parents had to sign it, and the child had to return it saying that it was okay for the child to come to Sonny's birthday party at Sonny's house.
At Al Capone's house.
You know, she was at Al Capone's house, indeed. May was very careful.
Irish-American May, who he had married when they were both very young. How do you square in the end? I mean, there's a lot of I want to get to here, but the monster side of Al Capone and the man, the family man that you are very prone to describe to us. How do you square those?
I don't. The thing is, I talk to, I don't even know, between 20, 30, maybe 40 or more Capone descendants or people who had been married to Capones or were in that that particular milieu.
Is it a Tony Soprano kind of thing where he's off, you know, with the barbecue by the pool and next minute you know he's beating somebody's brains in? What?
Could very well have been. The thing is, you know, I had extensive conversations with the granddaughters, and every time we talked about the wonderful man that they remember and the horrible killer, we'd use words like enigma, conundrum, riddle. And at the end, the complexity, the many, so many facets of this man's personality. You know, I wrote a book about Jung, so I have a lot of contacts. Yeah, I have a lot of contacts in the analytic world. Mm-hmm. And I called on them all, and I asked their advice, and I said, I'm not trained in the analytic professions, but what can I call this man? How can I find a totality? And they said, they really didn't know that there was one. They just felt that the important thing about my book is that I presented so many different facets and that I allow the reader to make a decision.
Linda in Loveland, Colorado. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just calling because my first husband, who's now deceased, his grandmother used to bootleg for, you know, for the city. They were farmers and didn't make a living at it. So they started bootlegging, and Al Capone was one of her customers. And they had a little tavern. I come from East Dubuque, Illinois, and it's right on the Mississippi.
Sure.
And he used to come there occasionally. During Prohibition, we had there was like 32 taverns in two-block area.
Wow.
And gambling casinos that weren't legal. And he used to come and buy his booze from Grandma. And she told me, she said, oh, I just loved him. She said he would come in and always give me extra money for the booze that he bought. And she said he always came with at least two guys with big, long trench coats. But she said I could always see, she called them Tommy guns.
Mm-hmm.
She said I could always see the Tommy guns underneath the long trench coats. And their bar kind of sat back in the wall. It's a very hilly area.
Yes.
And very close to Chicago. So he would come down there occasionally, and she loved him. She thought he was wonderful.
The grandma who loved Al Capone when he came for his bootleg pickup. Does that add up to you, Deirdre?
It does, because that's how they got their booze, how they had most of it made. They would send out the supplies to the various households and say, okay, you make the booze, and then we're going to buy it and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's a very real story.
We've just got a few minutes left. Describe how it fell apart, his arrest, his imprisonment, and then the sad end of Al Capone.
Well, they couldn't get him on any of the murder or other criminal charges, but they got him on tax evasion. Remember, the income tax started around 1916, and between 1916 and, say, 1924-25, the laws weren't clear. Some people, you know, you had to volunteer. If you thought you owed taxes, you volunteered to pay them. And so Al, of course, ignored this because he said, well, he had no legitimate income, so therefore he didn't have to pay taxes. And
okay, there's a lot.
Really, was it wasn't Elliot Ness. It wasn't that whole untouchable myth. It was a bunch of tax accountants and FBI agents who followed the money. They found the few books that the outfit kept, and they were able to pin all sorts of charges on Al Capone. In years since, various bar associations have reenacted that trial, and they say there is no way in the world he would have been convicted today where the laws are clear. But at that time, and as one of these lawyers said, well, it was Chicago, and things are different in Chicago. So he went to prison.
We just got a couple of minutes. He was in different prisons. He ended up in Alcatraz with serious syphilis and came out in big trouble. How many years later?
Oh, yeah. He had the mentality of somewhere between 7 and 12 years old when he was released from prison. And they took him home to Miami. He loved being on his estate in the last couple of years of his life. He died in his bed with his wife and his son and grandchildren and all the rest of the extended family around him. And he was 47 years old when he died. He was very young.
What year was that then, 1947?
That was 1947.
47, that's right. 47
he was almost. He was 48, actually, 48 in 1947.
What did his family do with his legacy? Here they were, they're in Miami, they got the big house, but a tough story behind it. How did they handle it in his son's generation and following?
Well, May had to sell the house in 1952, and she sold it to someone who kept it for a year and a half, 2 years, and then flipped it, and it had a bad time between then and now. Nobody really wanted it. It was too big and too costly to keep up. Sonny, the restaurant business fell apart, as did his marriage. His wife took the daughters to the West Coast. They bore the Capone name. They kept the Capone name. Sonny changed his name. He used his middle name, Francis, as his last name, because he said to his ex-wife, there will never be another Mrs. Capone after you. And he died close to his daughters, who loved him and took care of him. And the daughters have made wonderful marriages, have had excellent careers, have raised fine children. But they and all of Al, the descendants of Al's siblings, of his brothers, they all have different names. They all do not discuss their Capone heritage. They didn't even know each other. When I wrote the book, I was responsible for so many family Capone family reunions because I would introduce the cousins on the West Coast to the cousins in the Midwest or to the cousins in the Chicago area, none of whom knew of the existence of each other until I came along.
The long aftermath of Al Capone. It's an incredible story. Deirdre Baer got very close to it with all of those family connections. The new biography is Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. Deirdre Baer in New York, wonderful talking with you today. Thank you for sharing the Al Capone story with us again. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Maeve Pages, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Haliba Gikandi and Weiwa Lee. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.